I'm reading from the NIV version, from the book of Daniel, chapter 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God in Babylonia, and put the treasure in the treasure house of his God. Then the king ordered Ashpenaz, chief of his court officials, to bring into the king's service some of the Israelites from the royal family and the nobility, young men without any physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude for every kind of learning, well-informed, quick to understand, and qualified to serve in the king's palace. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. The king assigned them a daily amount of food and wine from the king's table. They were to be trained for 3 years, and after that they were to enter the king's service. Among those who were chosen were some from Judah: Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official gave them new names: to Daniel, the name Belteshazzar; to Hananiah, Shadrach; to Mishael, Meshach; and to Azariah, Abednego. But Daniel resolved not to defile himself with the royal food and wine, and he asked the chief official for permission not to defile himself this way. Now God had caused the official to show favor and compassion to Daniel. But the official told Daniel, "I am afraid of my lord the king, who has assigned your food and drink. Why should he see you looking worse than the other young men your age? The king would then have my head because of you." Daniel then said to the guard whom the chief official had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, "Please test your servants for 10 days. Give us nothing but vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then compare our appearance with that of the young men who eat the royal food, and treat your servants in accordance with what you see." So he agreed to this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of the 10 days, they looked healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who ate the royal food. So the guard took away their choice food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables instead. To these 4 young men, God gave knowledge and understanding of all kinds of literature and learning, and Daniel could understand visions and dreams of all kinds. At the end of the time set by the king to bring them into his service, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. The king talked with them, and he found none equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they entered the king's service. In every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus.
Thank you so much, Carol and Tyler and team, for leading us so well into God's presence this morning. There is a large, loud buzz going on up here on the platform, and if there's an easy way to fix it, maybe we can. If there's not, no problem. But I just thought I'd let you know that up here there's a loud buzz. By the way, Barb Aslan passed away last night. We have been following Barb and Ernie for a number of months now. Barb has been fighting cancer, and last night or this morning at 1 a.m., she went into the presence of Jesus. I've spoken with Ernie this morning. He's doing well, and most likely the service will be this Saturday, probably around 11 o'clock, but we will send something out as soon as we know. Also, not next week, but the week after, Ralph and Ruth Shoresky Our international workers from Heidelberg, Germany, are going to be here speaking and ministering to us, but they happen to be here this morning. So would you guys stand so that we can welcome you in advance? Yep, they're all of our missionaries are our favorite, but you guys are just a little extra special. Well, exiled and excelling, Daniel chapter 1. We're going to tackle six sermons in Daniel starting this week, taking a little bit of a break. Next week, Jim is going to preach a very important message on what it means to be a green Christian. It's going to be on creationism. It's Good Seed Sunday, and we're very excited about that. And then, of course, Ralph and Ruth will be with us the next week, and then we'll hit back into Daniel. It'll take us into June, and Lord willing, there will be some good things for us as a church family from at least the first six chapters. Like many of you who grew up with the Bible and with Bible stories, the story of Daniel played a major role in my life as a kid, in my biblical imagination. The first real Bible that I had, not counting the one that I received from the Gideons when I was in grade 5, was a King James version of the Bible that was beautifully illustrated with these colored pictures of all the best Bible stories. And of course, no Bible publisher worth his salt would ever think of illustrating a Bible without at least one picture of Daniel. And so this was the picture from my Bible right here. And I looked at this picture probably hundreds and thousands of times as a child, because I had that Bible for a long time. And I remember that during those days, we children were not without their parents in church. We had Sunday school, and then all the kids were with all the parents. And as I would sit suffering through a lengthy sermon, I would page through my Bible and simply look at all the pictures from Genesis to Revelation. So really, boring, long sermons had a very redemptive influence in my life and in the lives of my peers who had pictures in their Bibles. And then, of course, as a Christian teenager attending a very secular high school in Calgary, the story of Daniel became particularly relevant because Daniel was in this three-year program. He was a God-fearing teenager, and the school that he was in was run by the Babylonians. And I thought, well, that's just like my life. My school is also run by the Babylonians. Daniel became a primary Old Testament icon of what it looked like to be in the world but not of the world. Or he showed us what it was like to be a Christian in a world that was very hostile to things of God. And then in 1978, this particular album came out, and the prophetic voice of Keith Green provided the musical soundtrack that went with the biblical narrative of Daniel. And we heard, "Make my life a prayer to you. I want to do what you want me to. No empty words and no white lies, no token prayers, no compromise." How many of you remember that? Yeah, all the old people. For those of you that are too young for this, or you weren't a Christian during the Jesus People Revolution, you at least know the story of Daniel and his friends because you've heard about Rack, Shack, and Benny. And the VeggieTales version of the book of Daniel, which is in many ways is extremely clever. But we don't live back then anymore. We live in 2:16. Yet the story of Daniel continues to shape our worldview as a church. It provides hope and courage for those particularly for whom the fiery furnace is a daily reality. Christians worldwide who are losing their lives to organizations like ISIS. And in a society that we live in right now, here in Western Canada, where we are not presently being persecuted, but nonetheless, a society that's becoming increasingly hostile to the idea that there is only one God who has manifested himself exclusively in the historical Jesus, who said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life," in a world that is finding that message very unpopular, the book of Daniel is particularly relevant because it helps us to not only sink our roots and our convictions into who God is, but it helps us to do it in a way that doesn't force everybody else to. So Daniel actually wouldn't make a very good Republican. And that's the only political statement I'll make all day. That'll get me at least 5 emails, I'm sure, but I'm up for it today. At least he wouldn't be a very good member of the Tea Party, because nowhere does Daniel try to get Babylon to become a Hebrew state. His witness and his evangelism is so through the side door. It's really beautiful. And so it's a very relevant book because it challenges the church to live out the gospel in a culture that can be hostile. But I have to admit there are pitfalls in the book of Daniel, because it would be very easy for us to jump to moralistic conclusions at the end of every sermon where, you know, whoever is preaching just says, "Okay, everybody, now let's get out there and be like Daniel." Or let's get out there and don't be like Nebuchadnezzar. And that actually wouldn't be very helpful at all. Because what we're going to learn is that the Holy Spirit, who is present in our church, is actually going to give us just the right ways to be Christian in this culture, and it will look so different from Daniel. Now, having said that, it is very popular today to use the book of Daniel as a moralistic guide to a better, healthier life. How many of you have ever heard of the Daniel diet? How many of you have heard of this? Okay, a few of you. I'm surprised that not everybody's. I could have put probably 100 books on this slide. These are good Christians saying that one of the most helpful things we could do today is take Daniel's diet of vegetables for 10 days, and if you can hack it for 3 years, and you will come out feeling and looking better. In fact, you'll be just like Daniel, no physical defect, handsome, showing aptitude in every kind of learning. Now, I'm being a brat. However, I want the record to be set clear. We are not going to use this approach in our series. And I'm sure that doesn't surprise you. In fact, what we will see throughout these 6 chapters is that just because Daniel did certain things in a certain way doesn't mean that we should. So just because Daniel ate vegetables doesn't mean it's more godly to do so. And just because Daniel prayed only upstairs with his window open towards Jerusalem doesn't mean that we have to, for the same reason that we don't have to build an ark just because Noah did, right? We as a church have the freedom to discern how the Spirit will take this book and use it to help us to be the most effective that we can be in our particular culture. So Daniel actually won't emerge as the star of the show at all. And I bet you can guess who will. So here's the big idea of our sermon today. Because God is sovereign over the events of history, we can thrive in exile. Because God is sovereign over the events of the nations, we can thrive even when we are forced to live in a place we don't want to live in, with a people we don't want to be with. And chapter 1 will sort of give us an overview of where we're going, and it will also highlight what we mean by the sovereignty of God and what we mean by thriving in exile. So let's dive in. There's 4 movements or 4 scenes in our kind of one-act play here, and they are exiled, educated, eating, and excelling. And I only worked for about 5 minutes to get that alliteration, but I got it. So let's take a look at exiled. So I know your Bible's open and you're looking at verse 1 and 2. These 2 verses simply state the fact of what happened in history. They provide the date and the chief political characters who were alive at the time that it happened. So what it's telling us is that this event happened 6 centuries before Christ, 600 BC, And Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, attacked Jerusalem, and it says he not only carried off the plunder from the temple, but he took the best and the brightest young leaders. So let's take a look at the map that we have here. There it is. So, of course, Jerusalem here up against the Mediterranean Sea and Babylon here in the middle of the picture. And Nebuchadnezzar's army would have gone up the Fertile Crescent, up the Euphrates River, and then would have attacked Israel from the north and then taken the best and brightest all the way back to Babylon. And the two cultures just couldn't have been more different. This is what it looked like. Putting it in a modern-day scenario, what happened here would be like President Putin marching into Kiev, destroying every major symbol of Ukrainian society, stealing Ukraine's wealth, and then taking hostage to Moscow the most brilliant intelligentsia of Kiev, but men and women who were still young enough to be brainwashed into everything Russian. The funny thing is, you can almost see that happening. It hasn't happened quite like that, but you could see it happening. It did happen 600 years before Christ, but it was Babylon and Jerusalem. Now, I'm looking out over this crowd, and some of you are old-timers, and you've heard this story many times, but some of you are just brand new to the faith. Some of you have recently been baptized. I'm looking at you. Some of you are just in the process of being discipled into becoming a mature Christian, and you don't know anything about what I'm talking about here, but you probably figured out when you looked at that map that the people who live in Babylon are the bad guys, and the people who live in Jerusalem are the good guys. And if you figure that much out, you're absolutely right. The bad guys attacked the good guys, although we have to be honest that the good guys weren't being all that good. And so the question might arise, why would God allow his own people to be so violently attacked? I thought God was supposed to take care of his people. It's a good question. And there's not a simple or a simplistic answer. But if you take a look at verse 2, not only is God allowing this horrible thing to happen called exile, but in this case, he's instigating it. It says, "And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand." The Lord? You mean the Lord and King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon are in cahoots with each other? Yes, they are. In fact, in Jeremiah, the Lord calls King Nebuchadnezzar my servant. Now, of course, Nebuchadnezzar will take all the credit for what happens, but God is clearly behind the exile. God is willing it. You see, when God entered into a covenant with the nation of Israel, the covenant came with certain blessings and curses associated with obeying and disobeying the covenant. And so he said, here's what will happen if you remain faithful to my covenant. There will be blessings. And here's what will happen if you are not faithful. There will be curses. So let me give you an example. You'll see up on the screen Deuteronomy 28. It says, "Then the Lord will scatter you among the nations from one end of the earth to the other. And there you will worship other gods, gods of wood and stone, which neither you nor your ancestors have known. Among those nations you will find no repose, no resting place for your soul. And there the Lord will give you an anxious mind, eyes weary with longing, and a despairing heart. And you will live in constant suspense, filled with dread both night and day, never sure of your life. In the morning you will say, 'If only it were evening,' and in the evening, 'If only it were morning,' because of the terror that will fill your hearts and the sights that your eyes will see. The Lord will send you back in ships to Egypt on a journey that I said you should never make again. And there you will offer yourselves for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but no one will buy you." This is really difficult for people to accept. We hear this kind of thing, and we often say to ourselves, the God of the Old Testament is just so harsh. But what you will find is, if you read through the New Testament from cover to cover and get right to the end of the book of Revelation, you will discover that it's exactly the same God. And I want to say something about this. There are two non-negotiables that run through the Bible, and I think the sooner that we can come to grips with these two non-negotiables, the less we will say, oh, the God of the Old Testament is just so harsh. The first one is this, and it's a universal principle, that people reap what they sow. Even in light of God's grace and mercy and redemption, taking our worst sins and brokenness and turning it around and even using that for our good and His glory, it's still true that we reap what we sow. Parents try so hard to teach their children this, that, honey, if you get that tattoo, it has nothing to do with whether God will forgive you or whether God will love you. It has nothing to do with the redemptive power of God at all. You just need to know that if you get the tattoo, you're stuck with it. It's called prudence. If you make this decision today, this will be the outcome, and yes, God will be there in the outcome for you, but what you sow, you will still reap. And then the other thing that's just a non-negotiable, Old Testament, New Testament, is that whom the Lord loves, you finish it. The Lord disciplines. Whom the Lord loves, the Lord disciplines. For no father ever spared the rod from his child. For what child ever said, you know, I'm now quoting from the book of Hebrews about how every son and daughter understands that the discipline of the father is motivated by love. And so in this particular story, if there's a primary message, it's that the Lord deeply loves his people and he gives them the gift of his presence even while they're being disciplined. And I just got to throw this out. This is one of the reasons why giving disobedient kids lengthy timeouts can be challenged. Because when a child continues to be defiant and the parents take the child and put them in a room and close the door and walk away, the child could come to believe that when the child is bad, they don't deserve the parents' presence. I'm not telling you how to raise your kids. I'm just saying that when God disciplines his people in the harshest way, he never removes his presence from them. He sticks with them. I would not say you're a bad parent if you believe in using a timeout. I'm just saying we need to think about what it's communicating. So, exiled. Apparently, that just got everybody's attention. Okay. Number two, educated. Here, this is going to be the tough thing about the exile. Daniel and his friends are handpicked because they're so outstanding, and they're going to become a part of Nebuchadnezzar's elite class, part of the intelligentsia. They're going to brainwash these kids, hopefully, and these kids are going to be the culture shapers for the world. After 3 years, they might return back to Jerusalem as Babylonian influencers or remain in Babylon serving in the king's court. But in effect, Daniel and his friends are now being immersed into a culture. It's the culture of their enemies. And it's going to be incredibly difficult. They're going to have to learn the Akkadian language. And the religious worldview they grew up with is going to be countered by everything in this school. They're going to be exposed to all kinds of occultic arts of divination, and they're going to learn the reading of omens and the practicing of Babylonian magic, and that's going to become very clear when we get into chapter 2 and 3. It is a very occultic culture. As Tremper Longman has said, not only did Daniel take the Babylonian class, but he graduated summa cum laude, in other words, with highest honors. And along with the complete re-education of these boys, they would have a chance to live life in the fast lane. They would eat and drink from the kids, from the king's table. It would be the lifestyle of the rich and famous. And perhaps the most notable point in this whole reinculturation is that the boys received new names, Babylonian names associated with Babylonian gods. So, for example, the name Daniel, which means God or Jehovah is my judge, was changed to a god, may a goddess protect the king. That would have been a bitter pill for Daniel to swallow. And Azariah, which means Yah is my help or Jehovah is my help, was changed to Abednego, which means servant of Nabu or servant of one of the Babylonian gods. And the truly shocking thing about this whole renaming is that the Hebrew boys didn't choose to fight this battle. Apparently, this wasn't the hill to die on. It's like they got together and, like they always did, prayed for wisdom, and God just said, just take the name. Just take the name. It's not who you really are. And so the Babylonians set out to completely brainwash the Hebrew teens in all things Babylonian, but to say that their strategy backfired would be a colossal understatement. So how did the boys dig in their heels? We're going to have fun with this one. By what they ate. So verses 8 to 16 talks about their diet. It says, but Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or the wine which he drank. This is interesting. So far in our story, Daniel and his buddies have indicated no resistance whatsoever to this reassimilation into Babylonian ways until it came to food. Beef and Bordeaux? No, not for these boys. Just broccoli and Brussels sprouts. Yes, it's interesting to see what makes Daniel dig in his heels. What's motivating Daniel? What does Daniel hope to accomplish by taking a stand on the issue of cuisine? And honestly, I don't know. And the commentators all agree to disagree, but as you look at the various options, even if they're partially true, it gives a little bit of insight into what's going on in the heart of a Hebrew teenager who has been forced to do all things Babylonian. So the first option is that Daniel simply wants to stick to a kosher diet. And, you know, I can see Daniel getting to this place where he says, okay, you Babylonians, you've changed my homeland, you've changed my name, you are forcing me to do everything Babylonian, you are forcing me to go to your school, but the one thing you cannot force me to do is eat your cuisine. I will be reminded every day of who I am. You can take the Hebrew out of Jerusalem, but you cannot take Jerusalem out of the Hebrew. And the way I will be reminded of this is through my Hebrew diet. I will only eat vegetables. Can you see the problem with this particular point of view? The problem is the traditional Hebrew diet is neither vegetarian nor teetotaling. They ate meat and they drank wine. In fact, everybody did in the Old Testament and the New Testament, except a select few of people who were like Samson, who was a Nazarite, or John the Baptist, who not only refrained from any alcohol, but all kinds of other quite bizarre things. Secondly, Daniel might have known that this food was being offered to idols, and so he said, no, I'm not eating that food if it's been offered to idols, and this could be highly likely, yet how would Daniel know that the vegetables have also not been offered to idols? Why just the meat and the wine? Some suggest that Daniel, knowing the food came directly from the king's table, was actually rejecting the implied relationship or covenant that was in the heart of the king. Now remember, for the last number of years, we've talked about this many times, particularly because the Eucharist is so important to us as a church, that in the Bible days, if you shared food together, it meant you were entering into a covenant together. And so for the king to say to these boys, "Boys, you're eating my food and you're drinking my wine, and we all know what that means. We are becoming like this together." And Daniel goes, "Oh, no, we're not. If that's what it means, I'm not going to eat your food or drink your wine." And perhaps Daniel knows, this is number four, that at the end of the 3 years, if the four Hebrews prosper, the Babylonians are going to take all the credit for it. So they're going to say, "See you guys? Our education and our ways and our culture and even our food is better than your Hebrew ways. Look at how smart and trim and handsome you are now." Again, Tremper Longman makes an interesting point here. He says, "By refusing to eat the food of the king, these boys know that it is not the king who is responsible for the fact that they look healthier and better nourished than any of the young men who are eating the royal food. Their robust appearance, usually attained by a rich fare of meats and wine, is miraculously achieved through a diet of vegetables. Only God could have done that." Interesting. So I don't know, but I think it's really interesting what some of the options are. What is absolutely for certain is that these four guys were not doing this as a hunger strike. They were not doing it publicly at all. This was completely confidential. There's only one man in all of Babylon who knew that these men were eating vegetables, and it was the steward who was responsible for them. The king certainly didn't know. He would have none of this. And the other thing is that when Daniel was first refused the vegetarian diet, he didn't panic or freak out or do any of that stuff. He respectfully asked for permission and then provided a simple plan with a timeline. And he said, "Listen, why don't we try this diet for 10 days and let's see how we're doing. And if it works, well, you could lengthen it a little bit. What's the worst thing that can happen?" And God granted them favor. And so what was the result of this test of integrity? Number four, they excelled. They excelled. And I won't take time to read it, but it just says that in every single branch of literature and learning and knowledge and understanding, the four Hebrews were head and shoulders above everybody else. It says 10 times better than the magicians and the enchanters in the entire kingdom. And when Nebuchadnezzar had a one-on-one with these guys, it just blew his mind of how these men excelled. Okay, what can we take away today from this? Well, two things. First of all, we can take away a bit of a lesson in wisdom for how to live in a culture that can be very hostile to Christian convictions. And I think in one word, the way of wisdom is kindness. Kindness is the way forward for Christians. Convictions with kindness. Peter said, "Always be prepared to give an answer for the hope that lies within you, but do this with gentleness and respect." So having solid biblical convictions but not communicating them with class has no value for the culture at all. And so much could be said here. I think we need to remind ourselves that there's really only been one nation in all of history that has ever been in a covenant relationship with God, and that's ancient Israel. And I want to say this very respectfully, that the United States does not have a covenant relationship with the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Only God and Israel have been bound by covenant obligations that no other nation state has ever been bound by. There is no such a thing as a Christian nation. And one of the best things that the founding fathers of the U.S. did is come to grips with this and talk about a separation of church and state. But our American siblings are still a little bit confused about this. Well, is God in a covenant relationship with people? Yes. Who is God in a covenant relationship with? The church that is transnational and transcultural. God has a covenant with us and Christians everywhere who live in every nation in the world. And this doesn't mean for a minute that we shouldn't stand up for what we believe is best for society, but we cannot impose on secular people and on secular governments our Christian convictions. Daniel's goal was not to make Babylon one nation under God. And I know that'll make a lot of people really angry to say that, but it simply wasn't. But boy, did he ever make an impact. But his impact was not made through political or coercive ways often used by Christians who seem to believe that resistance to the government is the only way to make our point. Daniel and his friends are operating on the exact opposite premise of resistance to the government. Now, does it mean that Christians never stand up to the government? No, but the Spirit will give us wisdom if we're listening to know when to resist and when not to resist. If anybody modeled this, it was Jesus. And of course, in the 1940s in Nazi Germany, Dietrich Bonhoeffer and his colleagues resisted. And I think many Christians look back on the 1940s and they say, we should have followed Bonhoeffer sooner. There was a time. However, there are many more beautiful, creative ways to be a Christian in an unbelieving world. And I think it has something to do with being as innocent as doves and as shrewd as serpents. And I think that as a church here, we're learning what it means to be beautiful in this particular culture and how we are going to win the hearts of people who are not believers so that we can actually engage in the kind of relationships with them where the kingdom moves forward in really beautiful, dramatic ways. You go, really? The church and the government together? The church and the business community together? Yes. And secondly, in a time in history where it's really scary and where extreme Islam is growing extremely rapidly and ISIS is doing their thing, what we learn from this story is that God is not surprised by any of it, and he is in control. God is in control. Three times in our story, we see the similar refrain. It says, and the Lord gave, and the Lord gave, and the Lord gave. First, it says, and the Lord gave Jerusalem into the hands of Babylon, verse 2. Then, and the Lord gave the four teens knowledge and understanding in every branch of literature. And then the Lord gave the chief official sympathy towards Daniel and his friends, verse 9 and 17. This is very important. God allows the bad thing to happen and then presences himself with his people in the midst of the bad thing. And as Tyler prayed, because we are an Easter people, if we die, we will rise again. Sort of like what the three Hebrew teens said in chapter 3. Go ahead, throw us in the fiery furnace. And if we lose our lives, it doesn't matter. But we are not going to bow down to your God. More on that coming. We sing about this all the time. We sang about it this morning in that beautiful song, He's a Good, Good Father. That's who you are, and I'm loved by you. That's who I am. That's who I am. That's who I am. And then the next phrase, You are perfect in all of your ways. We also sing, He gives and takes away. He gives and takes away. But my heart will choose to say, Lord, blessed be your name. When we sing this, we are actually affirming God's sovereignty and goodness and presence in all of the events of our lives. And ultimately, the cross, the death of Jesus, would embody this better than anything else in the scriptures. You think about what was happening when the Lord was dying. Though something horribly evil was happening, God was entering into it, making a public spectacle of Babylon and all of the powers behind Babylon, and redeeming the entire world as a result of the worst thing that ever happened in history. That's what we mean by God is sovereign over the events of history. And there's no better place to be reminded of this today than at the Lord's table, because here Jesus, the servant host, is serving up himself. Broken body and shed blood. He's saying, let me nourish you to be these kinds of kingdom people in a world that is hostile to me. And learn from me as you learn from the story of Daniel. Yes, Lord, take all that is of you in this sermon and make it live in our hearts. And all that isn't, may it burn up as chaff. And continue to help us as people to live in the wonder of knowing that you are sovereign over all the events of our lives, and that even when we're in the toughest place, you presence yourself with us and love us through to the very end. In Jesus' name, amen.